Excuse me, but there's been some sort of mistake.
Oh, well, we'll sort that out later.
Oh, that's a good one, eh? We'll sort it out later, after you've been crucified. Typical bloody Romans, eh?
Now you can shut up.
Or what? I'll have to give up being crucified in the afternoons.
But I don't want to be crucified.
Oh, cheer up, Brian. You know what they say. Some things in life are bad. They can really make you sad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life.
See?
Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. If you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle. That's the thing. Hey, always look on the bright side of life. Very good. Always look on the light side of life. Life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your sin, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow. So, always look on the bright side of death. And just before you draw your terminal breath. Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh, but death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember, the last laugh is on you. Hey, always look on the bright side of life.
Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, in the bunker right here in the real first class, A number one, blue ribbon bunker right here in north central Indiana, where the rain falls sometimes quite a bit, but that was yesterday and the day before. Now we're back to sunshine and health. Oh, that's a nudist magazine. I remember when I was a kid, there used to be a magazine store, newspaper stand there in downtown, and way in the back they had the sunshine and health. Us guys, us junior high kids, would sneak down there in the back, and that old guy that owned the store used to run us off, man. Clark Mumaw was his name. Pretty sure he was Jew. I'm sure he was a Jew. Get on out of there, you boys. You shouldn't be looking at that stuff. Yeah. Hey, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And we have converted back, resurrected from the grave, the White Aryan Resistance. So we're back in the saddle again. Incidentally, Sunshine and Health was a hell of a lot better than National Geographic. But my favorite back then was the Sears Roebuck catalog. Boy, those lingerie ads, woo-wee, man. Now, before I get carried away here like I usually do, it's July the 25th, 2014, Moon's Day, and boy, if you're going to do it, you better get going. You've only got about, what? Let's see, this is all 30 days after September, April, June, and November. All the rest have 31. So you got 6 days left to get it done if you're going to do it at this time in the history of man. Right. And don't forget, we're right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station, where we still sell regular and Ethel. Of course, a lot of you young people never heard of that stuff. I used to love to smell that stuff when they were putting it in the car. That was my favorite thing, man, when Dad filled up the old Chevy at the gas station. Smell that gas. Ooh. I guess that's being sort of weird, but I like the smell of gasoline. Yeah. Even napalm in the morning, man. Yeah, there wasn't a dink body left, man. You know, I think I'm going to invest in a pig farm. Now, my cousin's got a pig farm. I guess I'll buy shares of stock in his outfit because we're going to need it, because we're going to have to take this swine lard, pig lard, and every bullet going to the Middle East now needs to be coated with pig lard. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, look back in history. Was it the Boxer Rebellion or one of those? Anyhow, that would solve a lot of problems. Now, in the Philippines, and I'm not for occupying another country, number one, but in that situation, they cut their opposition down a whole lot by every time they killed one of the guerrilla fighters, Filipinos. They'd bury him with a piece of pig in the grave. And that was the end of that. That sort of broke their resistance. So, you know, if you took that... in fact, that other deal was in India, I think, where they was able to get the opposition to quit fighting because they said that back then they had these bullets with paper or something on them, and they had pig fat on them or something. And they told these guys, man, if you're pulling that off with your teeth, you're gonna go to hell, man. And the Muslims ran like hell. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I'm glad those old boys don't like pork, because I sure do. Nothing like a pork chop or some bacon like that. Yeah, I love it. Yeah. Oh yeah, I've lost about 10 pounds here lately. I'm down to 180. I'm shooting for about 175, which was about the weight I was when I came out of the Army, as I recall. But if I keep losing like I have in the last couple of weeks, I've been walking a couple of miles a day, plus eating a little better and all that. Yeah, I'm going to be skinny mini, baby. Don't forget to spread the good news of eugenics around. Anybody that's a racial separatist, which you should be, is a eugenist, a person who believes in improving humanity, not even just white people, because every race can improve itself through eugenics. I'll tell you what, though, the Negroes aren't playing fair, because the Jews taught them how to breed into white people and create the mulatto race. So they're gene hijackers. They're not using eugenics right. Well, it may be working for the Jews or whoever's controlling, wanting to control the blacks. But they are gene hijackers. What was that science fiction movie where they used to... the aliens put pods in the room where you're sleeping, and you'd wake up and you'd be dead, and... an alien being that looked just like you come out of the pod? Well, that's close to what they're doing, man. The most dangerous thing going is these coffee-colored, light-skinned, especially females with quite a lot of white blood in them. You're going to see them taking over in the movies, even if there's a white so-called hero, but he's always got a black sidekick. They're already on the news programs and all that kind of stuff. You're going to see them really pushing that, and you're going to really see them pushing interracial sex between the mulatto women and the stupid white men who don't know any better, but should. Well, I tuned in this morning, and I think it was live. They're having this big funeral for the poor, poor child that was shot over in Missouri. Looked like one of these giant churches that white men built. Looked like 1,000 people in there. You're going to see all these white people in there too. Ooh! I don't go out of my way saying I'm thrilled and happy. I just have no dog in the fight. So I'm not interested. I observe this stuff. But I don't care whether they have a funeral or not. I don't care what they do. Now, you know, they're talking about we got to get these military arms away from the local police. Well, that's funny because the same government, through George Bush and Obamsky, gave them the arms in the first place. How does that work? First, they give them all these military arms, and then people start griping about it, and then they say, well, we got to do something about that. The same guys that gave it to them say, we got to take them away. Yeah. Strange, baby, strange. When I was first getting started in this struggle, I was in the John Birch Society back in 65, I believe, I started. And you know, we used to have a bumper sticker we put on the car. Support your local police. But also on there it said, and keep them independent. And that's what we were promoting way back then. Support your local police and keep them independent. Well, that's all down the tube now with Homeland Security and everything, the FBI and everybody. They're all mixed up together, so you might as well figure, if you're talking to a local cop, if there's anything important you're talking about, it's going to be fed right back to the FBI, Homeland Security, probably CIA and everybody else. So you better just stick to talking about the weather if you're talking to local cops, you know. And like I say, we used to call them peacekeepers. Yeah, peacekeepers, it's what they were. And of course, now they're all law enforcement, which has that cutting edge to it that I can't stand. I don't like law enforcement officers. I like peace officers. There's a hell of a lot of difference. The cops around here don't know whether to shit or go blind because of the meth explosion, and plus the wetbacks are coming in here like mad, and they're coming out of Chicago, coming out of South Bend, Fort Wayne, places like that, and they're all pushing drugs, and these cops are being run ragged run ragged, the county Mounties or the Barney Fifes. Well, let's see. Oh yeah, I wanted to tell you about this. You know how I told you about, you got to watch some of these revisionist guys and stuff like that, and sort of some of my, well, I came out and, you know, exposed the Cardo mess and all that money and stuff, and I stirred up a hornet's nest, and well, as Cardo's got these toadies that almost worship him, and one was Mike Hoffman, who is a revisionist. Well, I knew Mike Hoffman way back when he was in his 20s. He came to California and moved in just a few miles from where I live. I think he thought I had a big operation like Butler or somebody, which I did not. He rented a trailer in a trailer park not far from us, and he worked for me a little bit on the newspaper. But then I forget what happened. We quit using him, or he wanted to do something else. And one time we went to L.A. to one of our court appearances with Butler and all the boys, and we took him with us, and we were expecting to be confronted by the JDL, and we were a little bit, but nothing big, but enough that it scared the bejesus out of Mike Hoffman. That's the last time he ever went with us anyplace. This fella had a problem taking care of his wife. She made the money and supported him. I don't know whether that's still the case or not, but I've lost pretty much track of him as the years went by. And but we had one of his books. I think it's that book, They Were Slaves and They Were White, that Mike Hoffman wrote, which was a good little book. All the information is available. Anybody could have written that book. But we made the dastardly error to put it up on our website, PDF, so that everybody could read it. It's PDF all over the internet. So anyhow, I get a big official letter from Mike Hoffman, a special certificate and all this kind of stuff. But if you don't take this down off your site, we're going to do this and we're going to do that and this and that. And I said to my gal, I said, well, why didn't he just ask me in a nice way and I'd have done it? If ever I put something up that somebody's done that they don't like me to do, well, I'll take it down. But no, he had to make it official and try to hurt me with my server, because that's the only thing that all that official bullshit will do, is get your server upset. Well, my server didn't get upset. We took care of it. We just took it down. But that's sort of a sample, because I know he's associated with Willis Cardo. So I guess I got under Cardo's skin and they put out the word. Get Metzger. Well, anyhow, nobody's got Metzger, but I was a little disappointed, a little upset that I had befriended this guy back when he didn't have a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out of. But since that time, he's worked the revision thing and I guess made his living off trying to clean up the German image from World War II. Which is a lifetime job, baby. And so I don't know what he's up to now, but anyhow, we took care of it. I don't know why I'm telling you this, but I guess it's because there's a lot of phonies on the right wing that may write some good stuff, may do some good research, but as individuals, they're assholes. A lot of them are just not nice people. Not respectful, not courteous, not would you please. It's, if you don't do this, I'll get the law on you. Oh, I thought you talked about how bad the law was. I thought you guys didn't like the law. Anyhow, let me find some other stuff, something else that you may be interested in.
Sirius XM Progress 127. 866-99 Sirius, 866-997-4748. The question is this Bank of America settlement enough? Was any of the penalties paid by any of the banks enough? Did they properly pay the price for the damage they did to the United States economy? Did they properly pay the price for the damage they did to people's homes? Did they properly pay the price for fraudulently taking advantage of people's mortgages for auto and robo signing documents? Have they paid any of these prices? Let's play New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman on the Bank of America settlement.
This was an egregious pattern of misconduct over a period of years. Their due diligence process was clearly flawed. There's a statement of facts in which they've acknowledged this. I give credit to the bank. They've put a lot on the table. They've gotten a lot of claims resolved. It was good working with their lawyers to finally come up with some creative solutions. And this is a much more creative settlement than the Citi or J.P. Morgan Chase settlements that we've did in the past. It provides more money for affordable housing programs. It's going to enable states like New York for us to help tens of thousands of homeowners and communities all over the state to rebuild. So we're taking the money from the institutions that caused the crash, and we're using it to help revive the communities that to this day are suffering under the lingering effects of the crash.
Well, there's the point. You have people who, as a business strategy, who as a portion of their how they determined strategically they were going to profit from housing, defrauded homeowners, caused untold amounts of damage to the economy. Remember, most Americans' savings, most Americans' retirement savings is in their homes, is the mortgage they've been paying. So when, first off, the value of that home plummets, you are hitting Americans right in their savings. But part two, if you foreclose on the loan, if you do all these things, you are literally stealing Americans' retirement safety. You are stealing Americans' wealth. That's what you are doing. And banks have not done anything to show any remorse for this, either in the penalties they pay, which are rounding errors on their balance sheets, the fact that their officers have not paid any price, and the fact that, by the way, previous settlements have not been followed up on. And here's Attorney General Eric Holder. Here's what he had to say about the settlement.
So I want to be very clear. The size and the scope of this multi-billion dollar agreement goes far beyond the cost of doing business. This outcome does not preclude any criminal charges against the bank or its employees, nor was it inevitable over these last few weeks that this case would be resolved out of court.
Yeah, but here's the thing, Attorney General Holder. We've never seen charges against the bank or its employees. You don't plan on bringing charges against the employees of the bank. If anything, the Justice Department has continually let these people slide. And that's just why I'm skeptical of all these settlements, because they never seem to be enough. They basically seem to be, let's do a big enough settlement to get a headline, a good headline, but not so big enough that it would hurt the bank in any significant financial way. Not big enough that it would actually cause a change in behavior. Let's think about it that way. So up next, I really want
to... Well, let's switch over to the right wing and see what they got to say this morning. How about that?
Headline from the Washington Times. DHS saw no option but to free 169 illegals convicted of murder. The administration says it had no choice but to release almost all of the 169 immigrants with homicide convictions that were let back onto the streets last year, claiming court decisions gave officials no choice in the matter. But it's a promising a new system that better screen who gets let out. Of the 169 immigrants with homicide-related convictions released in fiscal 2013, all but 15 were required to be let go because of specific court orders or because the immigrants had been held for too long under the rules established by a sweeping 2001 Supreme Court case, the Homeland Security Department said in an August 15th letter to Senator Chuck Grassley. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Chief Tom Winkowski, said they're changing the rules to make sure a senior supervisor screens the release of those kinds of immigrants in the future. The 116 murderers were a fraction of the 36,007 criminals ICE released in 2013. The criminals had convictions ranging from homicide and manslaughter to drunk driving and sex crimes. You know, it's funny. The progressive left in this country, the race baiters, the organizations like La Razza, the academics, they point the finger at someone like me and they say, you just don't like brown people. You just don't like the fact that this country's changing. Well, it's one thing for a country to change. It's another thing for the country to be changed. Do you want more murderers on the street? I mean, here you have this complaint over the heavy hand of law enforcement in Ferguson. And the president saying, well, after we militarized the police, now we've got to rethink it. So we'll take away all this cool guy gear that we gave them and put more murderers on the streets. Does that make sense to anyone? I'm asking an honest question. I don't ask a lot of questions on this program. I make statements. I present arguments. I tell you what it is. How could that make sense that you want to pull back law enforcement and release more murderers? That is like a sick movie plot. I'm thinking Armand Asante in the movie Judge Dredd. You want chaos? I'm the chaos. This is all part of Cloward Pivot. You are creating chaos in the streets, one way or the other. Whether with law enforcement or without law enforcement. Either law enforcement we're going to create chaos when law enforcement does their job, or we're going to create chaos by preventing law enforcement from doing its job. You know, I've said on this program many times, I don't know what it would mean to be a veteran, what it means to be a veteran who is asking himself, why did I do what I did? Why did I do it? You know, here's Iraq falling back into the hands of the people. I lost friends fighting. Lost a part of myself, maybe physically or mentally. Why? Why did I do that? For what? I don't know what it's like to be a police officer who's watching this. And when I say I don't know, I mean I know from my police officer friends who send me text messages right after the program. What it would be like to be a police officer who is not understanding. You gave us this equipment. Now you're berating us for using this equipment. Now you want the equipment off the streets, but you're going to add to the mix more murderers. For those of you that, and I include my libertarian friends in this, that complain about the cops, put yourself in cops' position. The cop did not go out and personally buy that armored personnel carrier. The cop didn't go out and personally acquire any of the gear that you're seeing on the streets of Ferguson. That was given to them by the Department of Homeland Security, Governor Jay Nixon, and the mayor. So if you're saying, hey, cop, why do you have that armored personnel vehicle? Well, why don't you go ask the president? Why don't you go ask Jay Johnson? Why don't you go ask Chuck Hagel? That cop didn't just, he didn't go down to armored personnel carriers, or us, saying, what do we want here? See, something with a V-10. You know, Officer Smith, what can I do for you? I don't know. Something maybe with a V-10, you know, pretty good pickup. I mean, gas mileage, who cares? Seats, I don't know, 10 to 12 officers. Got anything with a turret? That's not how this works. The cops aren't going out and getting their own, you know, in some cases, yeah, there are police chiefs that are getting a little bit, my friend in the Army calls it geardos. I was reading one story where they were asking a police chief, well, what do you need with 1,000 bayonets? He was like, I don't know, they made it available. I mean, if chiefs of police are taking stuff from the DHS just to take it, you can blame them all you want, but I always say it's not always the sick bastard who tells the joke. Sometimes it's the sick bastard who laughs at it. If I tell you a joke that's completely offensive in nature, and you laugh, and you go, oh my God, what? You're sick, why did you tell me that? Well, I'm not the one laughing, you are. You can't blame a chief of police for taking a crate of bayonets. You got to blame the person that gave them the bayonets. You got to blame that guy. So here you have a Department of Homeland Security that is overseeing the distribution, and it is Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security is getting this stuff from the Pentagon and then giving it to police departments like Ferguson. So the police officer is in the middle here. And nobody turns down free stuff. None of you would. None of you would. If somebody comes along and says, hey, Officer so-and-so, wouldn't it be cool if we had this six-wheel armored vehicle? Damn right that would be cool. I'd want one of those. I mean, if somebody came along, we were talking about bug-out vehicles earlier in the program with Frank Miniter. If I had a little over $300,000 to spend, I'd probably be tooling around in one of those Knights Conquest vehicles. I put it up on Twitter. That thing is amazing. It's an up-armored SUV. But nobody's coming along and asked me that. But if I pulled up to the gas station in one of those things, and somebody's like, hey! Somebody obviously driving a hybrid, like a Prius. Hey! Now where'd you get that from? Somebody gave it to me. Like it? Cops are people. Police chiefs are people. People respond to incentives. If you say, hey, Chief so-and-so, you want an attack helicopter with a rotary gun? Sure. Yeah. I love the movie Blue Thunder, by the way, with Roy Scheider. I actually have it on DVD. That was the whole point of that movie, was this secret helicopter program was going to be used for urban pacification. Great movie, by the way. Daniel Stern, Roy Scheider. I saw that movie in the theaters when I was a kid. And I have it on DVD. Love it. But no police chief is going to turn this stuff down. But here's the funny thing. People like Barack Obama get to hand this stuff out, then act indignant. Act indignant like they did. Well, I can't believe. How did this happen? Like Jay Nixon. Jay Nixon's out there. I'm pulling back the National Guard. You're the one that ordered them in the first place. The National Guard didn't just show up. We got a call from the Ferguson PD. They said, bring all your stuff. So here we are. You get those armored personal vehicles. You get those Humvees out of the air. Jay Nixon told them to bring that stuff. John Lewis told them to bring that stuff. John Lewis was the genius who said, we don't want people in camouflage uniforms with rifles on the streets of Ferguson. We're going to call in the National Guard. What? You say what? I don't know what it's like to be a police officer and get all these mixed signals. You're giving the police all this cool guy stuff. Now you don't want them using it, but you'll put murderers on their streets. This is the problem. And if you asked any progressive, see, they thought They thought by federalizing local law enforcement would become what they wanted it to be, which is part of their top-down machine as long as somebody like Obama was running the show. Again, anarchists went out of power, tyrants went in power. So, thanks to the Department of Homeland Security, and look, I have no problem with police. This is where I'm sure a lot of my libertarian friends are not going to be happy. I don't care if the police department has a tank. I care if it, I care how and when it's used. Getting all upset, look, they're buying ammo. Well, it's not the ammo purchase, it's what the ammo purchase is for. But if you're going to say, Mr. and Mrs. Progressive, police shouldn't be using this stuff, well, then you tell Obama to stop giving it to them. And if you don't want them using it, why would you turn up the heat and say, not only are we going to take away your armored personnel vehicle, we're going to put murderers on your streets. So you don't want us using cool guy stuff to crack down on crime, but you're going to give us more murderers to deal with. Oh, well, that makes perfect sense.
Well, think of another reason they're giving them all this stuff. Well, it's simple. If they can't leave it over there in the desert just to rust up, not even try to bring it back in the Middle East, they got to get rid of it somewhere, somehow, so they can make more, manufacture more. The military-industrial complex, they don't want to shut down any arms manufacturing factories in this country. If they don't get rid of this stuff somehow, they can't manufacture anymore. You see that? That's the part of the story that most people don't think about, because the military-industrial complex is an extremely, extremely expensive operation to run. Plus, they've got the payroll of thousands of Americans that wouldn't want to give up their weapons of mass destruction jobs. And they'd fight to the death to keep that job where they're building weapons. Even I'm not innocent, because in the 60s, and from 61 to 65, I was Douglas Aircraft, working on not just the Moonshot rocket in the lab, but the intercontinental ballistic missiles that we were testing out, firing them from Vandenberg Air Force Base down to Kwajalein in the Pacific. And the equipment I worked on was part of that. So I was part of this military-industrial complex deal too. And at the time, we didn't think anything about it. Ah, it's a good job, man. I like the job. It must sound strange, but I don't think most people that work for the military-industrial complex think about it, about these weapons of mass destruction. I think they just punch the clock and do their job and go home. I don't think they really think about it. Here's a clip from a freelance reporter who was out there in Ferguson, Missouri. And what a cluster it is. It's pretty interesting. Listen to this.
All right. Well, good for Benedict Cumberbatch. I'm still not clicking on the link. I clicked my one BuzzFeed click for the week. So I limit myself. We're going to get to the deal of the day. We're going to get to the hero of the day here in just a second. But there was a piece that I saw. It's been going around the conservative blogosphere. I think I saw Instapundit link to this. Ryan Schussler has a blog, ryanschussler.com, and he wrote a piece yesterday, "I Will Not Be Returning to Ferguson." It's really interesting. He said, "I had been on the ground helping Al Jazeera America cover the protests and unrest in Ferguson, Missouri, since this all started last week." And he said, "After I saw what I saw last night, I will not be returning." So this would have been August 20th. He said, "The behavior and number of journalists there is so appalling that I cannot in good conscience continue to be a part of the spectacle." Now, Ryan's a freelance journalist So he was out there as a freelancer. But what he describes is exactly what we were talking about, I think, that day, Cam. I think we were talking about this on the show on Wednesday, the fact that there were more media than protesters, the fact that, you know, many members of the media are seeing this as their big time to shine, right? This is building their resume right now.
Well, it's become a cause celeb for many literal celebrities. So a lot of people are there to try to hobnob. And, you know, like I saw this one interview with Don Lemon. I think it's Talib Kweli. He's a rapper. That was very uncomfortable to watch. He was not very happy with Don Lemon. But, yeah, it's a lot of that celebrity culture going on there, too, weirdly.
Yeah. Yeah, well, where there are cameras, you know, celebrities kind of drawn to them like moths to flames. I'm surprised we haven't seen any more, we have not seen more reality TV show people show up. You know? So Ryan Schussler says, things that I've seen. Cameramen yelling at residents in public meetings for standing in the way of their cameras. That does not surprise me one bit. Most camera guys I know are, or videographers, as we would call them, they're not that way. But having worked in local TV news, I know there are some videographers who they just get so wrapped up in their job, they don't really think about, and that happens with, you know, reporters too, but I've seen it happen with the videographers. He says, I've seen cameramen yelling at community leaders for stepping away from podium microphones to better talk to residents. Yep, that doesn't surprise me either. TV crews making small talk and laughing at the spot where Mike Brown was killed as residents prayed and mourned. Yeah, again, that doesn't surprise me. Because if you are a journalist, if you're a television journalist out there in particular, I would say, I don't know why this is, but you tend to, there's, I think, a tendency to sort of wall yourself off mentally and maybe emotionally when you're not on the air, when you're not doing these stories. I've just seen this from a local TV perspective, working in local television, working in local radio. I would not be surprised to see that magnified at a national level. He said he saw a TV crew of a to-be-left-unnamed major cable network taking pieces out of a Ferguson Business retaining wall to weigh down their tent. I've not seen that before. Another major TV network, he said, renting out a gated parking lot for their one camera and not letting people in, safely reporting the news on the other side of a tall fence. Again, doesn't surprise me. That doesn't surprise me at all. Journalists, he said, making the story about them. Yeah, we've all seen that. National news correspondents glossing over the context and depth of this story, focusing instead on these sexy images of tear gas, rubber bullets, etc. One reporter, he said, who last night, this would have been, night of the 20th, said he came to Ferguson as a, quote, networking opportunity. He later asked me to take a picture of him with Anderson Cooper. Again, just what we were talking about that day. I mean, you don't even have to be in Ferguson to see to know this is what's happening. You just have to kind of know the media. He said one anecdote that stands out. As the TV cameras were doing their live shots in front of the one burnt-down building in the three-block stretch of Ground Zero, he said around the corner was a community food/goods drive. I heard one resident say, where are the cameras? I'm going to go see if I can find some people to film this. And other, you know, when there's good stuff going on, when the community's coming together, cameras are nowhere to be seen. Well, we don't want to cover that. You know, we're here to cover the conflict. We're here to shine a light on the conflict, the deep-rooted causes for apprehension, fear, and anger. We don't want to cover a community coming together and doing nice things for one another. I mean, God, it completely destroys our narrative. We have to wait for the healing. We have to wait for the narrative to turn to the healing has begun in order before we can start highlighting that, right? Oh, the healing has already begun? Well, we didn't say it's begun yet. It can't have begun yet. We, the media, haven't given permission for the healing to begin. We're still in conflict mode. Get with the program, people. Ryan Schussler says there are now hundreds of journalists from all over the world coming to Ferguson to film what has become a spectacle. I get the sense that many feel this is their career maker. He said, in the early days of all this, I was warmly greeted and approached by Ferguson residents. They were glad the journalists were there. The past few days, he said, they don't even look at me and blatantly ignore me. I recognize, he says, that I'm now just another journalist to them, and their frustration with us is clear. In the beginning, there was a recognizable need for media presence, but this is the other extreme. They need time to work through this as a community without the cameras. And Ryan says, we should all be ashamed, and I cannot do it anymore. He says, I'm thankful for my gracious editors who understand that. You know, Ryan, I will say that Ryan is in the minority, sadly. I'm guessing the vast majority of journalists, if they read Ryan's piece, would roll their eyes. There in Ferguson, those journalists on the ground, if they read Ryan's piece, I'm guessing they would roll their eyes and say, Ryan doesn't have what it takes. You know, that's why Ryan's a freelancer, because he doesn't have what it takes, Cameron. He doesn't have the stones to get in there, you know, cover this conflict the way it needs to be covered, like I do. I think that's, don't you think?
I'm imagining that guy Ryan Riley or Wesley Lowery, the two guys who got famous because of this. I can imagine them reading this with just such disdain and, oh, good riddance. Let him go. We'll take care of it.
Right? Yeah. And the hero of the day. We got two of each since I was off yesterday. Our first deal comes from the Bristol Press in Bristol, Connecticut. Arthur Hapgood, he's 36 years old, from Waterbury, Connecticut. He's been charged in the murder of 1-year-old Zaniya Calloway. The Bristol Press says that Hapgood was known to smoke marijuana, treated with chemicals, police said, and witnesses said he smoked pot shortly before he stabbed the 1-year-old child on Monday. Went outside to smoke, came back into the home, began acting in a bizarre manner and, quote, talking strangely to his wife, according to witnesses. When his wife told him she was leaving the home, Hapgood, who has a lengthy criminal history, attacked his 19-year-old nephew before he grabbed a knife, backed his 11-year-old stepdaughter into a corner. His 11-year-old stepdaughter was holding the 1-year-old, and then he stabbed the baby. When police arrived on the scene, they found Hapgood naked. Police say that Hapgood regularly smoked, quote, wet marijuana cigarettes. I've never heard of this. It's apparently pot that has been soaked in formaldehyde and then dried. The combination, the Bristol Press says, creates a hallucinogen that can cause aggressive, unpredictable behavior similar to the effects of the drug PCP. Detective Mike Brash of the Bristol Police Narcotics Enforcement Team says, I don't know if it could cause what he did. It's possible. The second deal of the day actually comes from National Review. A.J. Delgado writing at National Review, no prison time, no deportation for an illegal immigrant who killed two girls. A judge in Oregon has dismissed the deportation case against Cynthia Garcia Cisneros. She's 19, she's an illegal immigrant, and she killed two young girls in a hit-and-run car accident last year. She was in the middle of removal proceedings, but now she's been released and she will not face deportation. Ta-da! National Review reports that she had permission to be in the country under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program instituted by President Barack Obama in 2012. You know, you've probably seen, either in your local paper or your local TV station, you've probably seen a story, a tug-on-your-heartstrings story about a plucky child who arrived here as a plucky young adult who arrived here as a child, got great grades in school, did all the right things, and now is worried about deportation or worried about how they're going to pay for college because they're illegal immigrants and they can't afford they don't get in-state tuition. You've probably seen these stories, right? Those stories get played up a lot. Have you heard of Cynthia Garcia Cisneros? Did the national media cover Cynthia's story? I've never heard about it until today. It was last October. She was driving in Oregon when she hit two sisters, 6-year-old Anna Dieter Eckert and 11-year-old Abigail Robinson, as the girls were playing in a pile of leaves. She apparently drove through the leaf pile, unable to see the little girls playing in it, and then she fled. She later said she didn't know that she had hit anybody. She claimed that she didn't realize that she had killed the children until her brother had returned to the scene, spoke with the father of one of the girls, and then went back and told her. She did not go back to the scene. Her boyfriend, A.J. Delgado, writes, took her Nissan Pathfinder to a car wash to have it cleaned afterwards, and both he and Garcia Cisneros initially lied to the police when they were asked about it. The parents of the girls and the fiancé of Anna Dieter Eckert's biological father say that they have forgiven Garcia Cisneros, and they asked for clemency. And, you know, look, the victims, I think the victim's statements should have some impact in the judge's decision here, but it should not be the only thing that matters. I mean, after all, this is about more than just justice for the family. This is about the safety of the community, if nothing else. Back in January, a judge sentenced Garcia Cisneros to probation and community service. Probation and community service for hit and run. A.J. Delgado says, though she avoided prison as an illegal whose felony conviction canceled her DACA protection, she was taken to an immigration detention center. The Oregonian reported that she was taken to the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, Washington, because she's not an American citizen. But after the felony conviction, she was in danger of being deported. The immigration judge in her case, name has not been released by ICE, canceled the deportation proceedings. And even though now she has a felony conviction, Garcia Cisneros is now back under DACA's protection and benefits. A free woman who qualifies for a work permit and a Social Security number. Now, again, I realize this is a completely different jurisdiction. We're talking about the state of Oregon here. We're not talking about the state of New Jersey. But compare and contrast these two stories. The story of Cynthia Garcia Cisneros, who killed two little girls and got probation. She was in this country illegally. She will not be deported. And Shanine Allen, who brought a gun into the state of New Jersey, a gun that she legally owned, a gun that she was legally allowed to carry in Pennsylvania. She didn't use that gun in the commission of a crime. Nobody was hurt by her bringing that firearm into New Jersey. And they're trying to put her behind bars for 11 years. While Cynthia Garcia Cisneros goes free. Well, there's... Let's get to the heroes of the day. First, from the Post and Courier in South Carolina, Annie Paris reporting. An Ashley Avenue woman in Charleston, South Carolina, told police she fired her gun at two teens who tried to rob her at her home on Wednesday night. Charleston police responded to the woman's home about 10:20 in the evening, found several bullet holes in the wall and window, according to an incident report. The woman told detectives that she was getting out of her car. She had her child in her arms when two teenagers armed with guns approached her from the rear of the apartment building. We don't know how old, by the way. She just described them as teenagers. The teens ordered her into the house. Once she was inside, she ran into her bedroom, put her child on the bed, and grabbed her gun, according to the police report. She walked into the living room where the teenagers were standing and then started shooting, finally the teens thrown out the door. Charleston police spokesman Charles Francis says no one's been arrested, but the woman and her child are okay. Our second hero of the day comes from WDSU in New Orleans. Police there say a robber was shot and killed by a homeowner in Algiers late Wednesday night. The crime was reported about 10 o'clock in the evening. Larry Levy, a neighbor, says, "I would have done the same thing. He was protecting his family." WDSU says, according to a news release from the New Orleans Police Department, a 28-year-old man and his 36-year-old wife were sitting on their backyard patio when a masked gunman approached and demanded money. They say the gunman ordered the couple into the home where three female children, ages 6, 13, and 14, were inside. And that's when investigators say the husband retrieved his gun and shot the suspect, fatally wounding him. Investigators have identified the suspect only as a 25-year-old man. His gun was recovered from the scene, according to WDSU, as well as the homeowner's firearm. Well, let's hope he gets his gun back soon. According to police, based on the initial investigation, they say there's no obvious connection between the shooter and the man who was shot. But this appears to be a case of self-defense there in Algiers, the neighborhood in New Orleans where, you know, in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, this was one of the neighborhoods that actually had armed neighborhood patrols looking out for each other. When Jenny Simone went down to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina and reported on this, this was one of the stories that she uncovered and that she talked about. She talked with these guys who, this was a neighborhood looking out for each other. They said, you know, the police weren't around, and every gun owner in the neighborhood basically took turns patrolling the streets, watching out for their neighbors, making sure that there was no looting, making sure that people were safe. And apparently that attitude of protecting your life and the lives that are important to you remains in place in Algiers, even though a lot of the damage from Hurricane Katrina, thankfully, is gone now.
Well, there's a few items I thought you might be interested in. Yeah, I was. I hope you were. Hey, I'm straightening out my library here finally after we've been here, what, 8 or 9 years from California? And I still had books and boxes. Anyhow, we're finally straightening things out to where I can find out what I need. I ran into a book here that I'm really glad I found because it was presented by the head of the American Independent Party in California to my friend Bert Miller, who had helped me and was a sidekick and a printer for me and all kinds of good stuff. In fact, he led me into the more racial aspects of this struggle early on. And it was presented to him by William Shear. Now, most of you people I know wouldn't know William Shear, but he was the head of the American Independent Party when George Wallace was running for president out there. So I was all mixed up in that stuff in the American Independent Party. So anyhow, the book is called, entitled, The Cult of Equality, and I was so impressed because the author is Stuart Omer Landry, and this book was first printed in 1944. The Second World War wasn't even over, and I just started reading it. It's an excellent book. Which he took on this equality cult head on way back then. And he did a great job on this book. It says here, as was expected, the cult of equality was received with mixed emotions, and opinions about it ranged from extravagant praise to bitter denunciation. Yeah. Equalitarians, and many of those who have been won over by the propaganda against so-called intolerance, reacted violently against it. On the other hand, the author has received letters from people all over the South, as well as some from the North, complimenting him and agreeing with his conclusions. Strange to say, Negroes themselves have not objected to the book, generally speaking. Many of them have purchased it. In fact, it is selling well in Harlem until one of the editors of PV, the well-known Negro newspaper in Harlem, organized a fight against it. Ordinarily, this would tend to increase the demand for the book, but because of the limited number of copies available in the first edition, no effort was made by the publishers to take advantage of this situation. Negroes in the South, particularly New Orleans, bought the book freely. I have had some correspondence with one or two Negroes, and they have not objected to my ideas. Because the subject is so controversial, the press has practically ignored the book. Copies were sent to many newspapers and magazines for review. As is well known, no publisher in the North would undertake to put out a book like The Cult of Equality. In fact, no magazine or leading newspaper would dare print articles expressing such ideas. Now remember, this is clear back in 1944. That's a long time ago. We still have plenty of hardcore racists in this country. The Charleston News Courier referred to the cult as said it has had from the Northern reviewers and their newspapers and magazine media the silent treatment. In the great and greatly enlightened centers are no writers bold enough to notice the fact and the argument in Landry's book, much the less to confute and denounce them. The evidence is that the highbrows in the big burgs are afraid to mention Landry and his book. Now remember, this is 44, and they're already afraid to really talk about the fake deal of equality. Few even of the Southern newspapers mentioned the book, but several gave it exceptionally high praise. Some papers merely noted it in passing, and others commented uncritically. A few scientific journals mentioned the cult, more or less disparagingly. One such reviewer becomes personal in his sarcastic reference to the author, and in bitter scorn denounces him as an ignoramus. However, the reviewer, one of scientific journal, says that the book contains humor without meaning that it is unconscious. None of the reviewers undertook to understand the arguments made in the book, which arguments are based on facts obtained from the writings of scientists themselves. This was to be expected, of course, because the average scientist deals in formalized and conventional knowledge. Anyone, whether another scientist or a layman, who opposes the accepted thinking of a particular branch of science is anathema. It was hardly to be hoped that an independent, especially a layman, could discuss anthropology and sociology and receive serious attention from smug and cocksure professors, so I'm not surprised but only amused. In spite of the lack of favorable or unfavorable mention, the first edition sold out rapidly as the word about the cult spread from one reader to another. This, of course, is flattering to the author, since it proves the real merit of the book. Unfortunately, the paper's sarcasticity prevented a reissue immediately, and it was only recently that the publishers were able to get paper to print a second edition. It was probably because of the war effort. Among the charges leveled at the cult of equality are that the book is fascist propaganda and that the author is a fascist. See, it started a long time ago, boys and girls. Did this start? When you cannot meet a man's arguments, you call him a name. Today, in the whole world, there are only two names in all name-calling that really mean anything. One is the word fascist, and the other is communist. Both these words are used loosely, as a tendency to call a man with liberal ideas a communist. So a Tory, a capitalist, or even a large industrialist is often termed a fascist. The word fascist is applied by communists, socialists, and liberals to all reactionaries and to all those who do not agree with them on social or economic ideology. Actually, fascism and communism are economic terms. I will not attempt to define them, but I will point out that fascism is not capitalism, and above all that the word fascism cannot be rightfully applied to a conservative or to a person with a peculiar racial, social, religious, or other beliefs having nothing to do with economics. Fascism started in Italy and was not concerned with racism. Hitler, who adopted fascism over in Germany, used the so-called race issue, particularly as it applied to Jews, for propaganda purposes, but his anti-Semitism was not a necessary part of fascism. Anyhow, this book, that's part of the preface. It's about a, let's see here, looks like about a 360-page hardbound book. I see that abebooks.com has them. I was shocked that there were any around, but they run anywhere from $15 to $20 and sometimes a little higher. But the book is well worth it. We're going to be going into it a lot more as days go on and weeks go on. So that's it for today, Moon's Day. I'll be back tomorrow, and I think Swingblade's going to be on here with me tomorrow morning if everything goes right. So 14-5, and keep your powder dry. I had a woman call me on the phone. She asked me, I got a lot of ammo and I got some guns. Can I legally store them? I say, of course, by your own law. Don't tell anybody you got them. Don't tell the cops or anybody. Don't go asking the cops, what about this and what about that. Just make sure they're in a safe place. Don't tell anybody. She said, I thank you, Mr. Metzger. That's what I'll do. Later. And keep your mouth shut, except when you're putting out the racial separatist word. And what's the number one word we like to hear? Eugenics.